Good afternoon. It's Friday the 14th of February 2020, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me in the studio today, Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire. Welcome to the programme, Patrick.
Great to be with you, Mike.
Well, the news begins with the cabinet reshuffle and Sajid Javid. Well, his world has crumbled and he's been replaced by Rishi Sunak, MP, as Chancellor of the Exchequer. Now, many people suggesting that this is an attempt by Boris to sort of merge the functions of number 10 and number 11, that in the past, in the recent past anyway, there has been a bit of competition between them because number 11 holds the purse strings, number 10 has the policy agenda that they want to push forward, and sometimes those things don't sort of gel. But this, effectively, what has he done? He's put somebody who's ex-cabinet office straight into as chancellor, and in control, because what opportunity has he got to develop his own treasury policy in the next 5-6 weeks before the budget? None. So this is Boris's effectively taking control. So what's his history? He co-founded an investment firm working with companies all over the world, business career, Goldman Sachs, TCI, which is a hedge fund, ABN AMRO, another bank, Royal Bank of Scotland, and also Thaline Partners, and was a director at Catamaran Ventures. So quite a number of hedge funds in there. He was a Brexiteer. Let's look at what else is going on. Ben Wallace stays as Defence Secretary. No surprise there. Alok Sharma becomes Secretary of State for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy. The only reason I'm interested in him is because he has also become Minister for COP26, which of course is the big climate meeting later in the year. So that'll be his main focus, I would imagine, over the next few months. Anne-Marie Trevelyan moves from being the Defence Procurement Minister to International Development. So she is basically in charge of how much money certain elements within Syria get, certainly northwestern Syria anyway. Then we've got Oliver Dowden. He's of interest because he's become Secretary of State for Digital Culture, Media and Sport. So he takes over from Baroness Morgan, and of course he is going to be given the task of dealing with the BBC licence fee, decriminalising it, deciding whether the BBC gets to keep any kind of licence fee or whether it goes to a commercial model. But he'll also, of course, be responsible for pursuing the online harms legislation. So this is a key man to keep an eye on. Suella Braverman has become Attorney General. A little bit of a surprise to some because she has replaced Geoffrey Cox, who seemed to be pro-Boris, pro-Brexit, but apparently his face didn't fit. So she has moved into that job. Stephen Barclay, former Brexit Secretary, has been rewarded with the job of Chief Secretary to the Treasury. Here is the lovely Penny Mordaunt. She has, I apologise for the animation there, which is absolutely incorrect, but anyway, Penny Mordaunt has become the new Paymaster General, so she moves into the Cabinet Office. This is very timely. Unfortunately, didn't get the job in time, though, to meet with Prince Charles, who was visiting the Cabinet Office yesterday. So there is one king, Mark Sedwell, on the left, with the potential future king, Charles, on the right there. So he was there to, how did they describe this? To recognise the work that the Cabinet Office undertakes on behalf of Her Majesty's government and to thank the civil servants from across government for their work on a range of issues. So Mark Sedwell welcomed Prince Charles, as did Permanent Secretary Sir John Manzoni, alongside Michael Gove and also Oliver Dowden, the new, who was until yesterday the Cabinet Office Minister. Then followed with a tour of Whitehall. And they are mainly discussing, apparently they were mainly discussing preparations for COP26. So COP26 is absolutely going to be one of the main talking points this year, I think.
Mm-hmm. That's the big environmental shindig. I wonder if they're expecting an international agreement to come out of COP26 or not. That's the big question, because this has been the big push, especially after Paris. Is there going to be a binding agreement from the Western countries?
Well, this is perhaps why it's appropriate that that might happen in the UK. The UK driving forward with this, the UK financial sector driving forward with this. And although the event's taking place in Glasgow, there's plenty of enthusiasm from the British government to go ahead, and not so much enthusiasm perhaps from the rest of the population of the country as they begin to realise the implications of losing internal combustion engine cars and gas boilers from their homes. So,
I expect Mark Carney, is he currently the Governor of Bank of England?
He is just in the process of leaving that job, and he is immediately going to move into the job of being the government's advisor for COP26 alongside being the UN's climate change czar.
Mm-hmm. So he's going to feature heavily at this big climate change meeting in Glasgow.
Absolutely.
The other question is, how successful will Boris be if he wants to show a result to get Trump on board with the climate agenda? That might not be an easy sell.
Good luck with that one, I would have said.
In the current political environment in the United States, it's going to be very difficult.
Yes. Now let's head over to the Middle East and Turkey, Patrick. And really, it's been interesting to watch what's been going on, particularly with Turkey's activities in Syria.
Yeah, well, Turkey is in the process of trying to pull off some pretty extraordinary maneuvers at the moment. So let's take a look at what's happening first. President Erdogan, he has threatened to attack the Syrian government and Syrian government forces, and he's reaffirmed that threat this week. This all started with a miscommunication with the deconfliction office run by the Russians. Turkey didn't notify them, therefore a Turkish convoy got hit as they rolled in to Idlib. And so Erdogan, then the war paint came on after that. So here is Davut Bahçeli. He is Erdogan's kind of political partner, if you will, in this sort of coalition with the AKP party. And this is the party for the nationalist movement. And this is him giving a speech this week. And I call him Turkey's Grey Wolf, because that is the sort of nickname of this party, the Grey Wolves. Very Islamist, very much nationalist, very aggressive. Some might call this the fascist party within Turkey. And here he is giving his speech. And let's do the translation from the Turkish media and look at what he actually said here. This is what he said. If there is no any other option, this is a translation, so Turkey should immediately make plans to enter Damascus and destroy the oppressors. This is Davut Bahçeli. And he goes on just to clarify what his position is. Turkey must prepare to invade Damascus. The Russians are not reliable allies. The only friend a Turk has is a Turk. So this is sort of Erdogan's kind of extremist wing, if you will, of his kind of coalition that he's running right now. And so what's Turkey been up to? This is the question, and this is why it's complicated. Turkey's playing a very complicated game. It's got the United States on one side, NATO, and on the other side it has its relationship with Russia that it's managing, and then it also has objectives in Syria. But let's look at what Turkey's been up to recently. So here they've deployed what are basically repurposed Free Syrian Army brigades into Libya to fight to defend Tripoli on behalf of the Government of National Accord. This is recognized by the UN as the, quote, legitimate government of Libya at the moment. And on the other side is General Haftar. And this is a motley coalition of various world powers backing this former CIA asset. Russia is also siding with Haftar. So oddly, Russia, the US, Saudi Arabia are on the same side. And the UAE as well, and I believe France too, I'm not sure. But they all seem to be backing Haftar, except Turkey. So Turkey's deployed what are effectively extremist jihadis, Syrians, deployed to Libya, basically, to fight here. There's all sorts of spoils up for grabs here with Libya. I'm sure Turkey has maritime agreements and other energy agreements that they like to harvest from this relationship. That's just one thing. And over here, Turkey has repeated, he said it twice now, this is the second time in the last, say, 4 months, Turkey repeats that it's not going to recognize Russia's annexation of Crimea. That is a big move against Russia. So imagine they're having this close relationship with Russia, and then these announcements are coming out. Mm-hmm. So there he is with President Zelensky, pictured there, and this was just last week. And so, and to move on, this is quite, well, this will raise some eyebrows. The Ukraine is going to receive military aid from Turkey. So they're getting arms and multi-purpose goods and things that they can use for their military. $33 million worth of aid here. And this is going to the Ukraine. So this is quite contentious here. So Turkey, again, playing a kind of an interesting double game. What do we call it? Let's call it the Turkish twist. So what is the Turkish twist? This is Erdogan is adept at these dance moves, these pirouettes. And so there he is, the president, the prez right there. And let's look at the Russian dance. This is the dance that Erdogan is performing with the Russians. He's partnered with them with the Astana and Sochi peace plans, okay, meant to cooperate. This is to sort of de-escalate fighting in Syria and come on a kind of roadmap to stabilization and peace. And the Turkstream gas pipeline, this is from Russia. This is from under the Black Sea into Turkey and then feeding into Eastern Europe. This is meant, this gas project is massive. It's finished. They've done the deal. This is meant to supply natural gas to Europe to bypass the Ukraine, which is currently being blocked, let's say, by the Ukraine's relationship with the United States. Purchasing S-400 missiles, this obviously has, you know, upset the United States massively. One of the things, kind of a red line, if you will, that Turkey's crossed there.
And I believe they've received their first one this week, in fact.
That's right, that's right. So this is a big-ticket item from Russia that being purchased by Erdogan. And, of course, Erdogan's playing nice with Putin. They just had a phone call to reaffirm their commitment for the de-escalation zones in Idlib. Meanwhile, the whole thing is completely falling apart. So, and here's the American dance that Erdogan is doing, cozying back up to Washington now in the last couple of months. So something's changed behind the scenes there. Reaffirmed commitments to NATO, and whereby NATO was questioning Turkey's actions in the last 6 months. Now he's broken Sochi and Astana agreements. He broke the Sochi agreements. Turkey was meant to uphold the de-escalation zones. They were meant to separate the moderate rebels from the terrorists, and they haven't done that. In reality, there's no difference between the moderate rebels and the terrorists. We know that. But just for argument's sake, that was destined to fail. Turkey hasn't upheld its part of that agreement. Astana, it was meant to help secure the Damascus-Aleppo International Road, which is absolutely crucial to stabilizing Syria. They haven't done that. So on both of those agreements, they've broken them. Now, foreign jihadis' arms into Syria, Turkey has facilitated this from 2011 consistently. They're still doing it. So they're obviously, this is helping America. Washington likes this. So Syrian jihadis to Libya, Washington. I don't know how Washington feels about this. I don't know how anyone feels about it. But what it is doing is it's keeping these as a viable fighting force, which can be redeployed, effectively mercenaries. So what you might see is these Free Syrian Army jihadis transforming into a mercenary force, kind of like a professional mujahideen, if you will, which could be deployed all over the world, in fact. So this is good for the U.S. $33 million in arms to the Ukraine, and no recognition of Crimea in Russia. And so Turkey's interest, this is really what Turkey is pursuing, a neo-Ottoman agenda. They're also becoming a regional player again. This includes North Africa, the Sahel region, and projecting their influence further afield. We're already seeing that in Libya, for instance. So it wants to become a player again. This is a major goal. This is like make America great again, make Turkey great again. So think of Erdogan like you think of Trump. Very similar in terms of the nationalist reaffirming Turkey's place in the world. So to capture new economic markets, micro-colonialism, so this would be like Sudan, these were places like Somalia, Maybe they might have designs in the Arabian Peninsula and Yemen, perhaps. And of course, Syria. Syria has become a market for Turkey because they destroyed Syria's manufacturing mm-hmm. sector, and they're dumping cheap Turkish goods in there. So the new Turkey is, this is the main thing. They're transitioning from a secular to an Islamic state. This is a major historic transition, which is not really being reported very much. And so that's going on right now. It's been going on for the last, say, 10 or 15 years. Now it's really becoming noticeable. And a lot of people have left Turkey. Let's say middle-class, secular-type people have migrated away out of Turkey for various reasons. So this is a very contentious issue. So smash the Kurdish insurrection and expand the security buffer zone along the Syrian border.
So that's it. The question is, does Erdogan actually appreciate or have a plan? Because it seems he's fighting a proxy war in Libya against the US and everybody else. He's taking S-400s. That seems NATO can't be happy with that still, and yet he's trying to sidle up back with NATO, and he's trying to maintain relations with Russia and Putin. How is this going to work? How is it going to end?
This is what Turkey does, because this is Turkey's place in the world. They are at the bridge between the East and the West, between Europe, between Asia. So this is the only way that they can behave. And in the current world power structure that we have, as complicated as it is, with the United States pushing, with NATO and France, Britain have interests as well. Israel has interests. Everybody's pressing. Syria is the sort of hub of this pressure at the moment. Mm-hmm. And Turkey is trying to capitalize on this to what I think is increase, possibly also to increase territory by giving patronage to groups that it's populated into the border regions. And in 30 or 50 years, they could make a play again for that territory. So, but for them, it's a security buffer zone against the Kurds. And so very similar to how Israel has managed its relationship with Lebanon and some of its neighbors.
Is there no danger that they're just going to hack everybody off to such a degree that they end up with no friends anywhere?
This is the thing. It could be, but also people need Turkey as well. The United mm-hmm. States have Incirlik Air Force Base there. It's a very important beachhead for NATO, for the United States, for the Middle East and Asia. So and Turkey knows this, so it's just a painful, very complicated and grinding relationship mm-hmm. that will just continue. And the big worry is that Turkey could start a shooting war with Syria. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's going to happen. This is why they've used proxies and put those out front and deputized the Free Syrian Army and fold them into their military, because they don't want their soldiers coming home in body bags. Mm-hmm. But they're having to fight now because the jihadis are cutting and running in Idlib. Mm. So now this is a problem. So Erdogan talks tough to his base, like Trump will talk tough to his base, make Turkey great again. But when it comes down to it, are they ready for a shooting war? And if they do, the Turkish people are going to demand that it's worth it. Mm. There has to be a good reason behind it. And I don't think there is really that good reason there. And this is why he's really in trouble right now, potentially, Erdogan.
Okay. Well, if you like what the UK Column does and you would like to support us, then please head over to ukcolumn.org/community, and there are various options for supporting us there. Now, back to Europe, and the Munich Security Conference begins today. What are they talking about? They're talking about, or they're asking the question, is the world becoming less Western? They are concerned that the West is becoming less Western as well. And they're wondering what this means for the world if the West leaves the stage to others, as they say. What could a joint Western strategy for an era of great power competition look like? So this is, of course, how the West views the world of great power competition. This has been expressed most recently by the European Union in various formats. They're saying that a multitude of security challenges seem to have become inseparable from what some describe as the decay of the Western project. This isn't all they'll be talking about. This is the main feature of it. They see this as an existential risk, it seems. But they're also going to be heavily discussing climate change. They're going to be talking about Libya and Yemen. the Middle East, also Kashmir. Common security in Europe is a growing issue for them. They want to discuss that. They're saying that, this is really about burden sharing, of course, and NATO is represented and will be involved in this this event. They're also highlighting Russia's widening influence in the Middle East, Africa and South America. This is causing them great concern, as well as, of course, China, and China getting involved in Western IT infrastructure, and particularly 5G networks. This is something that's going to be discussed. So who's going to be at it? Well, let's have a look. Sergei Lavrov will be there, perhaps the only voice of sanity in the entire event, but there we go. Heiko Maas, the German foreign minister, Emmanuel Macron, the French president. Nancy Pelosi will be there, Patrick. I can't really imagine what role she intends to play, other than perhaps an anti-Trump, pumping in as much anti-Trump rhetoric as possible. Mike Pompeo will be there as well. Maybe he'll be doing the same thing. Mark Zuckerberg will be there. This is a very interesting thing. I'm not entirely sure what Facebook has to do with global security.
It has everything to do with global security now, because Facebook, Twitter, and some of these social media giants, they have a monopoly over these platforms that have all this information on them, that narratives are built on and travel on, and how information is disseminated. So in the information part of war and information warfare, Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook are very, very important to the military in terms of public opinion and what's allowed to trend, what's not allowed to trend, which accounts have to be taken down. Iranian Press TV, deplatformed. Robert Inlakesh, deplatformed. These are people reporting on a conflict, like as it's breaking.
Yes.
And they're gone.
Yes.
They disappeared.
Yes. And David Miliband, of course, this is the type of people that they have at this. Of course, he is in charge of the International Rescue Committee in New York. And these are the types of people that are going to be there. Other people there include Jens Stoltenberg, Zelensky from Ukraine, representation from Iran and India. We haven't heard yet exactly who will be attending from the United Kingdom. I'm sure there will be people. I'm sure Ben Wallace will be there, but haven't heard that for sure just yet. So let's move across the Atlantic, Patrick, to the United States. But we're going to have more money from Trump for war powers.
No. This is reining Trump in. This is an unusual piece of legislation. It's been talked about, Rand Paul and others, and certainly House Democrats have been pushing this. So the Senate is poised here to pass a bill curbing war powers. So, for instance, the Soleimani strike and the attack on Iran and Iranian assets that we saw in late December and early January, this would mean that he would need approval from Congress, from the House and Senate, in order to wage war. But it doesn't look like they're going to get the votes required to override a veto. So we're expecting that Donald Trump is going to veto this piece of legislation, this restraining him from waging war against Iran. It's going to be vetoed by the executive branch.
Is it correct to say that historically, constitutionally, the decision to go to war would be an executive decision? This is traditionally not something that Congress would have been involved in.
Well, it depends what traditionally is. If traditionally is the last 20 or 30 years, then there has been, at least in the last 20 years, an authorization of military force. And this has been an executive order that just keeps getting renewed and renewed. This gives the executive the power to bypass Congress. Traditionally, historically, constitutionally, there should be a congressional decision of whether or not to wage war. But the argument from this White House and the argument from the intelligence community is we don't have time to wait. And so you can see there's always this urgency narrative in all of these actions. Oh, there was a chemical weapons attack. Oh, their plans to Soleimani is going to attack all of our embassies in the world. So we need to strike now. We don't have time to to ask elected representatives for approval. So this has become the norm in terms of U.S. military actions. So I do applaud this move by, this has been worked on by the members of the House and the Senate, but I do applaud it. But at the same time, I don't think it's nearly enough, considering what we know about some of these times when the authorization of force has been used and is currently being used. Mm. There's no justification whatsoever. And so it's a shame that Congress has allowed it to get so out of control.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we're coming into the Munich Security Conference now, and just out of the NATO defense ministers meeting, here they all are gathering for the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS family photograph. So this is the Global Coalition gathering at the moment. What I find interesting that as we watch this, Patrick, is that Ben Wallace doesn't appear in this group of people. So I'm not entirely certain that Britain's excited about the fact that NATO is claiming success with respect to the defeat of ISIS. Maybe it was too much hypocrisy, even for him.
So are they saying they're going to defeat ISIS, or they've defeated ISIS?
Oh, no, they're saying that they have done so much to defeat ISIS that they can stand up and be proud of themselves. So
none of these people up here that I'm aware of, Mike, have done anything to defeat ISIS. Who defeated ISIS on the ground were the Iraqi military, were the PMU units, the ones that the U.S. attacked over Christmas, okay? The Iranian Special Forces, the Quds Forces led by Qasem Soleimani, they defeated ISIS in Iraq. Who defeated ISIS in Syria? The Syrian Arab Army, the Russian Air Force, Hezbollah. Again, Iranian Quds Forces. United States did nothing on the ground. NATO powers did zero on the ground against ISIS.
Absolutely.
A non-factor. So to see them here, Mike, in this glad-handing exercise is quite a laugh.
Well, I suspect that's why Jens Stoltenberg has this fixed grin on his face, because he couldn't feel happy about standing amongst this group. He knows the hypocrisy of what they're doing there, I suspect.
And worse, a lot of these European countries have imported some of these ISIS fighters through refugee corridors, and many of them have ended up back in Europe.
Absolutely.
And not just ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra. This is the same as ISIS. This is the same ideology. But somehow they've managed to separate them to sort of minimize the scale of the monster that they have created, that they've fed and watered and groomed all these years. And now all of a sudden they're congratulating themselves for defeating it, which is quite interesting.
Absolutely. Well, as I say, Ben Wallace was there. While he was there, he signed a declaration on the Joint Expeditionary Force, saying that it was going to make an enduring and substantial contribution to NATO's readiness initiative. That's positive news there. And UK is going to get involved in NATO's Baltic air policing. And it's also getting involved in NATO operations in the Middle East. So we're going to get involved, but we're, you know.
Well, Stoltenberg announced as well that they're going to up their training operations in Iraq. This is at the same time Iraq is asking foreign troops to leave the country.
Absolutely.
So I see that as a potential Trojan horse for the United States to maintain some presence in Iraq after they officially leave, which they eventually will have to.
Absolutely. Now, of course, can't discuss NATO without discussing NATO exercises. There's yet another one going on at the moment. This is Lithuania, Exercise Sabre Winter, and it's just wrapping up at the minute. So these are all U.S. troops involved in live fire drills. So 1st Armored Battalion, 9th Regiment, 1st Cavalry Division, all deployed. And so they're very excited. Of course, this is running up to the Exercise Defender Europe 20, which we've mentioned over the last few days on this program, and which is going to be the largest deployment of US forces in Europe for 25 years. So they're in Lithuania at the moment. Getting very excited there, Patrick. And as we mentioned the other day, I'll just mention it again, 29 NATO exercises last year. And of those 29 NATO exercises, 29 of them had Russia as the supposed foe. What is Russia supposed to think about that?
Well, I don't know.
No. Okay, let's move back to the United States then. And Roger Stone.
Well, the Roger Stone trial has popped up again in the headlines. This was the first move we saw this week of four prosecutors were told they quit because there was pressure from the DOJ to lighten the sentence of former Trump surrogate. He wasn't even actually in the Trump campaign, Roger Stone. And so the prosecutors quit in protest, as it were, because the Department of Justice, Donald Trump's Department of Justice, wanted to lighten the sentence, didn't want Roger Stone to die in prison. They've sentenced him to 9 years or something like this for a range of charges, all of which are very spurious, to say the least. But this was the first move here. And so there was a bit of an uproar here. This is how Washington works. You see stories leak out like this, and it will trigger a certain outrage with a certain faction. And then a couple of days later, you see another story pop up. And what was interesting, this story pops up afterwards here, just in the last couple of days. The person who was the foreperson, who's in charge of the jury, the head juror, basically turns out is a former Democratic congressional candidate, but also was a never-Trumper. An anti-Trump activist, a Democrat, and was also a friend of Donna Brazile. So she's from Tennessee. Her name is Tamika Hart. There's Roger Stone, and there she is. There's Tamika Hart. And so this is just unbelievable that a person who is going to decide, you know, whether he's innocent or guilty, and also on sentencing, head of the jury, is this biased. How did this get past Roger Stone's defense team? And knowing this now, there is an argument that it could be
a mistrial
or something like this. So, but here she is with Donna Brazile, former head of the DNC, Democratic National Committee, who was also caught within the Podesta emails as well as cheating during the Hillary Clinton debates. But there's Donna Brazile with Tamika Hart. And look at some of these tweets here. 45 may live here, but it's the people's house, talking about the White House, and we're here to tell him and the white supremacist racists, etc., that, you know, they have to go. And she's got a link. There's another tweet here. Anybody wearing a MAGA hat is a racist. So very anti-Trump. This is Tamika Hart. And but by the way, that one there, I think, was tweeted just before the verdict. This was also tweeted here in early 2019. So she's commenting on the Mueller investigation, basically. So Roger Stone's case came directly out of the Mueller probe. Mm. So just this tweet here that we're showing you, the last one, that would completely disqualify this whole proceedings.
In any normal judicial process, that would disqualify you immediately.
This is the worst possible outcome you could have for selecting a jury. I mean, so, you know, I came under heavy criticism because I called this a Stalinist show trial when Roger Stone was sentenced back in November here. And it seems like I was vindicated, I was correct. But here's the main point, and it's important that people get this. Roger Stone, one of the main convictions is that he lied to Congress. Mm. So during the Mueller probe, during the Russia investigation, he comes to Congress. And he said he lied about having a back channel to WikiLeaks. Okay, so the inference here is that the Russian GRU hacked the DNC and gave the emails to WikiLeaks, and that Roger Stone was trying to pump WikiLeaks for information in the background to find out when the next tranche of emails was going to be released during the 2016 election in the summer. And so they said he lied about. First, he said he didn't have a back channel to WikiLeaks, and they said that they found some text messages on Twitter between him and WikiLeaks, pretty nondescript, how WikiLeaks would interact with anybody sending them DMs on Twitter, that sort of thing. But anyway, so he was supposedly lied to Congress. Okay, there was never a back channel to WikiLeaks. Everybody knows this, even the investigators. It's been repeated. It's been proven. Okay, so they're saying he's going to do 9 years in prison for lying about something which never happened or something that didn't exist. It's like saying this, Mike. It's like saying I had a conversation with a ghost, and I tell that to the investigators, and then but the ghost doesn't exist. So they say, no, you didn't have a conversation. You didn't speak to the ghost. Yeah, I spoke to the ghost, but the ghost doesn't exist. There was no back channel to WikiLeaks. Mm. And they still haven't proven whether the Russians hacked the DNC and gave them to WikiLeaks. There's no evidence at all for that. So Roger Stone's conviction is about, it's about keeping the Russiagate narrative alive, fixed into place. Mm. Roger Stone represents the validity of the Russiagate hoax for the establishment. So if he doesn't get nailed, then basically Russiagate, he himself being sentenced, is holding the Russiagate. It's, you know, it's suspending the whole Russiagate narrative. If he doesn't get, if he doesn't go to jail, then the whole thing, they have nothing. They have no evidence from the Mueller report. They have absolutely nothing. All they have now is Roger Stone about to go to jail. And this is what the resistance or the people who promote Russiagate will say, ha, Roger Stone's been convicted. He's doing time. Therefore, it's true. It happened. But there's no evidence that it did. This is an unbelievable miscarriage of justice, whether you like Roger Stone or not. He's not the most savory of political operatives, mm-hmm. as far as political operatives go, but that's what he does. That's his job. Mm-hmm. So this is an unbelievable piece of justice that would happen in the 21st century. It's, to watch it happen is quite amazing.
Okay, well, we will end with another unsavory political character, Karen Pearce, currently UK Ambassador to the United Nations, soon to be UK Ambassador to the United States. I'm sure Donald Trump will love her. Well, she was speaking in the United Nations yesterday, and during her presentation, she said, Mr. President, on my first point, the United Kingdom believes that legal accountability for conflict-related crimes serves as deterrent, punishment, and a method for upholding victims' rights. And really, when I saw this speech from Karen Pearce, Patrick, the only thing that came to mind was this. And perhaps the UK should begin there. And perhaps if they did begin there, they might be able to justify telling the rest of the world how to behave on these matters. If we're not prepared to hold other people, our own MPs, past MPs, our own past prime ministers, hold them legally accountable for conflict-related crimes, then we can't really talk to anybody else, can we?
Well, it's the old adage, isn't it? One set of rules for us in the rules-based international order, and another set of rules for those who have to follow those rules. Of course, we make the rules so we don't actually have to follow them. Mm. Exception. But for everybody else, you must follow the rules. Karen Pearce, the enforcer. Very good.
Absolutely. Soon we'll be enforcing Donald Trump. Okay, we will leave it there for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Thank you for joining us, Patrick. We'll be back at the same time, 1 p.m. on Monday as usual. I hope everyone has a good weekend, and we will see you then. Bye-bye.